KK atop Seattle's Queen Anne Hill, it's Shamefaced, plugging the holes in a spotty education. I'm Vince Keenan.
And I'm Rosemary Keenan, and welcome to Shamefaced, the podcast that's a companion to our blog, Shamefaced, where we fess up to the classic books and movies we haven't experienced.
And do something about it.
So what's in the Shamefaced cocktail shaker this week, Vince?
Rosemary, nothing is in the Shamefaced cocktail shaker this week. Although we are enjoying a cocktail, we are having a Cure Royale.
Nicely said.
Yes, thank you. I practiced that. It's 6 ounces of champagne and creme de cassis. A splash is how it was described to me.
It's delicious.
Yes, it is. It's very nice. And again, that fine color. You can serve this in either a champagne flute or a wine glass. And my policy is, when given the choice between the two,
always choose the champagne flute.
Exactly.
Of course, much more elegant.
So this doesn't actually need to be shaken. What you heard earlier was just a sound effect.
You wouldn't want to shake it.
So we chose this drink for a couple of reasons. One is we bought a bottle of creme de cassis.
You have to use it.
And we're going to use it.
Yeah.
Even if it takes us the next 20 years. And the other is the two movies we're going to talk about today are movies that are about sex. And so we were thinking, well, let's have a cocktail that is suggestive of that.
Now, sex and romance and France and...
Yes. Yeah. And so there are a couple of cocktails that have names that are sexy, like...
Like Sex on the Beach is one.
Yes.
I don't know what's in that. And, of course, the Screaming Orgasm.
Yes, yes. But we decided, you know, this is not a bachelorette party.
No, it's
this
not
is a semi-professional bash. Podcast. And then you had the absolute masterstroke of saying, well, nothing is sexier than champagne. Let's have a champagne cocktail. So, sex movies. When I was in college, I, in fact, took a course called Body and Film. And it was a class that just, all the movies that we watched addressed the issue of sexuality in one way or another. This was a class, actually, that I lied to my parents about. Because when they saw, when my report card came, my mother said, "The Body and Film, what kind of class is that?" And I said, "Well, it's about structure, you know, like the body of a letter."
Oh, you didn't. Oh, that's terrible.
I did, because I didn't want to say, yeah, you paid all this money so that I could watch, you know, high upscale porno. And then, like, and you got an A in the class, so you must know a lot about structure. That was a fun conversation. But it was actually one of the best classes that I took, because I got to see some very unusual movies, like W.R. Mysteries of the Organism, which is a film by Dusan Makaveyev that's part documentary about Wilhelm Reich, who was the scientist who talked about cosmic energy, the healing power of cosmic energy, but it's also this very bizarre parable of Eastern European sexual awakening.
And how do I get a copy of this?
It's not at Netflix, I can tell you that, because I'd love to see it again. And speaking of seeing again, one of the movies that we watched in this class is Last Tango in Paris. Mm-hmm. So I had seen this movie, I saw it once in this course, and I have not seen it since, but you had not seen it at all.
Seen it at all.
It's kind of a cheat in that I've seen the movie already, but...
But that's okay. That brings a little bit of a different perspective on it.
Yes.
You were young then, not so much now. So Last Tango in Paris was directed by Bernardo Bertolucci. It's from 1973. It famously stars Marlon Brando and Maria Schneider. Bernardo Bertolucci was nominated for an Oscar for directing the movie, and Marlon Brando was nominated as well.
Yes. I did really want to see this again, because when I first saw it, I was, you know, but a wayward youth at the time. Hmm. What I knew about life and sex and women could not fill Maria Schneider's very fetching hat.
I love her hat.
Her hat's maybe my favorite thing about the movie. And at the time, after I saw the movie, it didn't go over well with all the other students. And I think that was part of the reason where I said, I don't know, I kind of dug it.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, I thought it would impress chicks if I said that. But I wanted the chance to see it again. And now that I know a little bit more, just enough about life and sex and women to fill the hat, I wanted to see it again.
Mm-hmm.
But as someone who has never seen it, I'm very curious to hear.
So I went through a few stages in seeing the movie.
Denial, acceptance.
Yeah, so while I was watching it, I found it compelling.
Yes.
I was fascinated what's going on, what's going to happen next, what is the problem with these people. And then immediately after the movie was over, I felt very dismissive towards it. I was like, oh, it was all overwrought, and some of the scenes were just too weird, and it's too much a product of its time.
Yes. We should probably very briefly sketch out what the movie is about, which is...
For those who haven't seen it. Do that?
Basically, it's set in Paris. Brando's an American living there. He and Maria Schneider look at an apartment at the same time. They end up renting it jointly and get together there for sexual liaisons, during which they don't reveal anything about themselves to each other. They don't know each other's names. They don't know anything about each other's lives. Their relationship is a purely physical one that exists solely within the confines of this apartment.
Right. But the movie itself goes outside the apartment, so you see what Brando's doing in his life, and you see what Marie Schneider's doing in her life, which includes having this boyfriend, who is a fiancé in the course of the film.
And who is played by Jean-Pierre Léaud, the star of The 400 Blows, an earlier subject of an earlier podcast.
And he's making a movie about her. So he's doing a cinema verite kind of thing about her and the two of them together, which is kind of an interesting counterpoint. So their relationship is being filmed, and she's having this other relationship without any names.
It's the opposite of the Brando relationship, in that he is trying to kind of plunge himself completely into her life.
Mm-hmm.
And she's his muse, and he wants to build a whole film around her and find out everything about her, while Brando is like, don't tell me anything about yourself.
So I said, so immediately after the movie, I was like, eh, it's just like some 70s thing.
I've heard that noise before.
Yeah.
Right? That dismissive noise.
But then, the more I was thinking about it, the more I was thinking that, well, I don't dismiss movies from the 40s and 50s because they're products of their time. I can sit here and enjoy a Douglas Sirk movie and talk about it and think about it and what he was trying to do and that kind of thing. So, I don't know. I think sometimes when the movies are closer to my own generation,
mm-hmm.
I feel like I want to be more dismissive. Maybe it's like bringing up something in myself that I don't want to deal with. Not
really?
To be personal about it. Yeah. So I don't want to dismiss this movie because I think it is fascinating. Even something that you just said now about how the two relationships, her relationship with these two guys are opposite of each other. Not really. They're actually exactly the same because both of these guys are just trying to get deep into this woman, if you know what I mean. And they really, neither of them...
But in both a physical and a metaphorical sense.
That's what I meant.
Yes.
But really, they are really interested in her, and the movie's not really interested in her. Each of these guys is just interested in themselves. The egos in this movie, one of them is like the kind of Hemingway-esque, Brando has this like overarching maleness and the leader of the pack, alpha thing going on. And Léaud has that other thing going on, which is the... Oh, I'm charming and I'm an artistic guy, but it's so all about him. You know?
Yeah, I know. That's a good point.
He's the director where everything just revolves around him, and she's just the subject. She's the other. So it was fascinating to me watching this movie. It's like, wow, you would think the movie would be about her because she's got these two guys just kind of fighting over her, and the movie is so not about her. It's about her curly hair and her beautiful face and, you know, all the rest of her.
Oh, yeah.
But it's not really about her at all, which is fascinating. And I don't want to dismiss that because from a feminist point of view or something, I want to think about that and explore it and think how things have never changed at the beginning of time. It's never about the woman.
Oh, that's so interesting to me. That is not a take on the movie that I think would have come to me, probably because I'm a guy, where... You know, my first instinct is to say, well, you know, they're both, that the relationships are mirror images of each other, and it makes sense to me that what you're saying is, no, they're just using the woman to express themselves in different ways.
Very succinctly said, yes.
So, you know, naturally I'm going to go, well, you know, they're each appreciating her in a different way, and you're saying, yeah, hold the phone there, Jack, that's not what's happening here.
Yeah, because whenever we go into her life, it's not really... her life, it's her relationship with this other guy. She's like, oh, I have to get to my job. Does she have a job? Does she have a thought of her own? Well, we don't really know. She has a mother. We find that out.
And a hat.
And a hat.
But other than that...
A lovely hat.
Yeah, we're kind of left in the dark.
Yeah, and of course, you know what Freud said about hats. So we won't... Oh. We don't
need
sometimes
to go there. Sometimes a hat is just a hat.
Sometimes it is.
Yes.
Sometimes not.
So, I mean, revisiting the movie was interesting for me. I mean, naturally, the first thing I have to say is that it looks absolutely fantastic.
That's
just the way that it captures Paris, but more importantly, the way it captures this apartment, where the apartment itself is, you know, it's huge, full of all these rooms that are empty and are there waiting to be filled. So you have that sense that it's a space that's pregnant with possibility, but at the same time, it's also kind of decaying and collapsing.
Mm-hmm.
So And Vittorio Storaro, his cinematography, as always, and Bertolucci, the way he moves the camera within that space is just amazing. In terms of what the movie is trying to say, it's one of the things where I think the fundamental points that the movie is making, they're interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Where, you know, this whole notion of trying to exist in a world where everything is expressed physically, where all of your emotions and thoughts are kind of expressed through sex, that there's a kind of a childlike nature to it at times that Brando and Maria Schneider are able to bring out. There's an animalistic side to it where it's like, if you're just purely physical, you're not really all that far removed from animals.
Right, they're grunting and
communicating through noises. And it's just fascinating. And then gradually, as time goes on, you realize that this is not the way to live a life, that it's very limiting, that it opens up some areas but closes off other ones. And again, you know, fascinating stuff. But the problem is the movie hits those points over and over again.
Over and over again, yes.
So on the whole, what would you say about this movie?
I think it's great, and I think it's fascinating. And while it is, you know, a child of its time or whatever, I think that actually makes it more interesting.
Yes.
To me, because we can analyze it just from, well, what does it talk about? Universal human truths, and mm-hmm. how do they still relate to us now, and how much was it maybe a reaction to the whole counterculture thing. It's like, oh, well, we're all just children of the body. We don't have to worry about intellect or anything. We can just be, let's just be here together. And Bertolucci's saying, you know, only up to a point. Or that's what I took from it.
And that makes the age difference between Brando and Schneider very interesting, because Brando's in his 40s and Schneider is just a slip of a girl. She's like 20.
Yeah.
And there is, you do kind of get the sense that this is an older person's take on what's happening and trying to, you know, to understand it and maybe experience it for themselves and realizing that it's limiting in some ways.
Right.
I mean, it's a hugely influential movie. One of the things I always think is fascinating about it is that Catherine Breillat is in the movie. She has a very small role as an actress, and she went on to become a director whose movies really kind of exist in the shadow of Last Tango because they're all about sex.
Right.
She made Romance and Fat Girl, and they're all movies that are about the way that sex affects people in their lives, particularly women. And so,
well, I was just going to say that, actually. I think it'll be interesting. I haven't seen any of her films, to see one of her films and to see how she can take that from the female perspective, because I think there are a lot of interesting things to be said from the woman's perspective about sex and power and need and how screwed up
Absolutely.
Everybody is.
Wrapping up Last Tango in Paris, it's a difficult movie. It's a somewhat dated movie. It's a hugely important movie. If you care about films at all, it's one I think you have to see,
you
know, why I watch it again, because I wanted you to see it.
I was shame-faced not to have seen it
Absolutely.
Already.
And so next we move on to Carnal Knowledge from 1971. It's directed by Mike Nichols and written by Jules Feiffer, who's probably best known as a cartoonist, I would think.
I would say so.
And what I understand about the origin of this movie is that it was originally written as a play, and at some point it came to the attention of Mike Nichols and producers very early on, and it was turned into a movie very early on in the process. It ended up off-Broadway in 1990, which is 12 years later.
A lot later, yeah.
So basically, the story spans 25 years, roughly, in the friendship of two men, played by Jack Nicholson and Art Garfunkel, here billed as Arthur. It starts out in the late 40s when they are in college and follows them through to the 1970s when they're in their 40s, they're professional men. And it basically chronicles their relationships with women, or more importantly, their relationship to each other as reflected in their relationships with women.
Right, which was fascinating, and that was not what I thought the movie was going to be.
No, not at all.
Because I hadn't seen it.
Because, I mean, it makes for a very interesting contrast with Last Tango because, I mean, yes, they're both movies about sex, and Last Tango is an extremely physical movie, but Carnal Knowledge is all about talking about sex. That's what the movie comes down to. And more importantly, what do men talk about when they talk about women? Watching this movie now, I can't even imagine how it would have played in 1972 because it just strikes me as almost experimental the way it's put together. The scenes are very short, first of all. It is propulsive. It's a 96-minute long movie, which is fairly short to begin with, but it's just one short scene after another.
Right.
And what's more striking about it is the fact that, and I think this is saying something very interesting for a movie that's about sex, all the action is off-screen. Whether it's sex or tennis, any kind of physical activity, that's what we don't see. It is just beyond the edge of the frame.
Mm-hmm. You know what makes me think of now is like a graphic novel or something, like Ghost World. It's all about talking and all about these two people and all the other stuff happens off screen. I mean, the compositions of the shots
are extraordinary.
They're amazing.
They are just absolutely unbelievable. And the most interesting thing about it in terms of it being, you know, originally a play, intended to be seen as a play, is that this is the rare movie that is not afraid of theatricality. It actually embraces it.
Mm.
That, you know, the big thing with movies that are based on plays is the producers say, well, what you want to do is you want to open it up more.
Right.
You want to, like, have a scene take place at a carnival. Get him up on the top of a Ferris wheel.
Yeah.
And here,
he goes against it. It's like, well, have a scene outside. Do a scene, like, on a tennis court. The scene on the tennis court, it's a static shot of the one woman and also Anne Margaret.
So, and we'll talk about
it a tiny bit. But the tennis game is happening off camera. And the guys are talking to each other
because,
like, behind your back when you're watching the movie.
Because what matters is the reaction of these two women to these two men who are doggedly trying to impress them.
Right.
So why should we even bother seeing Nicholson and Garfunkel killing themselves on this tennis court to try to impress these girls?
In some sense, watching this movie, it's like more audacious even than Last Tango, just the way the movie itself is, because I don't think you see anything like this now. You see plenty of couplings on the floor, but you don't see much of where the director's like, you know what, let's have the guys just talk off screen and have the camera point at something more important.
It's just so daring, you know.
And if I might, too. So the movie is about the relationship between the two guys.
Yes.
Most certainly. As seen through their, like, interactions with these women, but Nichols, I think he's smart enough to say, you know what? The camera's going to be on the women. There's that great shot of Candice Bergen in the bar.
In the dark. Oh, my God. She's never looked lovelier than she does in this shot.
Yeah, and it's all, let's just keep the camera on them. And you in the audience, you need to figure out that the movie isn't about her. He makes you work at it. It's just
great. That shot is very similar to that tennis shot where Candice Bergen is playing Art Garfunkel's girlfriend, but he does not know that she is also recently taken up with Jack Nicholson,
mm-hmm.
Even though the two of them are friends. And so again, it's a shot where they're both laboring to impress her. They're each trying to get the biggest laugh out of her, and she's mm-hmm. just happy to be with both of them. And the shot is just her, blonde, in the darkness. It starts with her in the middle of that fantastic Candice Bergen laugh, and it's really just breathtaking. How this scene works. It was just a treat to watch.
Definitely.
And so, I mean, we have to talk here just about the nature of the talk in the mm-hmm. movie, because these two men talking about women, what they want from women, it's at times it's brutal. It's very unsparing. It's almost clinical in the way they describe, you know, not even their emotional needs, but what they expect the woman to do for them.
Yeah, well, how far did you get in first base, and yeah.
And it's kind of amazing to watch this movie and see how the women are don't get a chance to contribute. We don't get to hear what their point of view is, and their absence just underscores the fact that women, because any kind of sexual activity is going to have a greater toll on them, it just underscores how much more is at stake for women by not having them in here. I hope that kind of makes sense.
Because, it certainly did for me while I was watching the movie. It's like,
but I mean, what did you think of it as a woman watching these men talk and this locker room kind of dialogue?
I don't know. It was so grounded in each of their characters that it was totally believable to mm-hmm. me. And yet, I wondered, you know, what the woman would be thinking. Like when Candice Bergen decides that she's going to go out with both of them at the same time, it's kind of like, well, what is she thinking? But then you know, well, she's young and she's in college, and one of them's the good guy, and one of them's like, ooh, the bad rebel kind of a guy.
That would be Jack Nicholson.
Yeah, right, in case you couldn't figure that out. And so she wants both those experiences, which is totally understandable.
Yes.
But then she pays for it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you knew, like, either way she was going to pay for it, because Nicholson is kind of a bit nuts, you know. He's not altogether a healthy personality, and Garfunkel is so boring that immediately, in the first scene, she's like, well, I want to be a lawyer. And then we hear a little bit later, oh, she's home with the two kids. Well, that never happened.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But maybe it's just something that, you know, back in 1949, educated women would tend to say that, you know, hoping against hope that actually they would end up getting married.
Yes.
I don't know. Maybe the majority of it.
So, having the movie not include the women's perspective, did that...
Well, there's only so much you can do. Mm-hmm. So, no, I think the movie totally worked in what it was doing, because it was about the male perspective. And if you tried to also then bring in the woman's perspective, you would be skewing
You'd be diluting
it.
The impact,
I
think.
Yeah, it's like the people who complained about In the Company of Men.
Yes.
The Neil LaBute movie, mm-hmm. play movie. It's like, oh, well, and the woman is treated so badly. Well, yeah, that's the point.
That's the point.
It's these two guys, one of them worse than the other, but both of them not so great. Yeah. And their relationship to each other and the power between the two of them. Mm-hmm. And
well, I certainly think, we talked about this when the movie ended, Neil LaBute has to have seen this movie many times.
You
because
would think
I think
so,
this
yeah.
is really, you can trace his movies. And I'm a big fan of his. I really like his mm-hmm. stuff. I think he clearly is working in the shadow of this movie. And another movie it actually reminded me of, interestingly, was Closer. Which Mike Nichols made only 2 years ago, and which is
right.
another movie, again, you know, written by a playwright, that is just about unrelentingly harsh language about sex, about, you know, where essentially you have two characters, different characters pairing off, having these very intense and at times brutal conversations about sex,
right,
and the toll that it takes on them.
Right, and hard to watch even for the audience sometimes. And that movie is written very much about the two couples. So it's about the men and the women are both kind of in there equally, which works for that movie because that's how it's structured.
Work.
You know,
but this is very much a movie about, you know, like the male gaze and, you know, what it's like on the gazer's side.
Yeah. And how bad that can be for the person who is like that.
Yes.
Because where Nicholson ends up, man,
that's
not
a dark
where
place.
You want to be. Yeah.
And just to say a word about the acting, Anne Margaret in this movie.
Oh my God.
Is absolutely fantastic. She was the only member of the cast, I believe, to get an Oscar nomination. And I've always liked Anne Margaret, you know, dating back to the Flintstones. But she is just a revelation in this movie.
Talk about, just like Brando in Last Tango. She puts herself out there.
Every way imaginable.
It's about her body. It's about her being older. And I mean, it actually does talk about, well, what does she want from life? And Nicholson completely can't understand it.
Can't understand
how he screws her over. And screws her up and gets her into this state where she's trying to kill herself.
Oh, yeah. And Candace Bergen, also excellent. And Rita Moreno shows up. She's at the scene, the last scene with Nicholson where he's in a dark place, as you've said. And again, just amazing work. It's just top to bottom, everything about this movie just blew me away.
Yeah, and I was so surprised by it because, like I said, I really didn't know anything about it, and I get it confused with that other movie that Art Garfunkel is in.
Yes. Which I saw in my body and film class, Bad Timing, Essential Obsession.
That makes sense that you would see that. And so I was just thrilled and excited by this movie.
Yeah, and to watch it with Last Tango was very interesting because Last Tango has this huge reputation as one of the great movies, but watching them again back-to-back, I was really taken with Carnal Knowledge. I think that actually holds up better.
I think back-to-back is the one position that was never dramatized in the film.
Well, we didn't watch the uncut version.
That's true. Sorry. Couldn't help it.
And now it's time for the shame-faced word we didn't know. And once again, I will be doing this segment. And once again, it comes from a review in The New Yorker.
Okay.
Ain't that always the way?
They do challenge us there.
The word is marmoreal.
Marmoreal.
Marmoreal. It is an adjective. It means of, relating to, or suggestive of marble or a marble statue, especially in coldness or aloofness. So it wasn't really used in a positive way in this review that I was reading.
No, and I wouldn't have thought that. Hearing the word, it actually sounds like it might even relate to our theme. It sounds like sexual almost.
Oh, like as in marmoreal, that costs extra?
No, as in mammalian or mammary.
It actually comes from the Latin marmor, meaning marble.
Oh.
And this just underscores the fact that I really should have taken Latin in high school when I had the chance.
You should have.
You can find Shamefaced on the web at our blog, Shamefaced, that's shame-faced.blogspot.com.
If you'd like to email us, you can email us at shamefacedblog, that's all one word, shamefacedblog@gmail.com.
You can also find me on the web at vincekeenan.com. Pop culture, past and present,
high and low,
one day at a time.
Today's music by Evan Tate was brought to us by podsafeaudio.com.
And that's as good a place as any to bring this installment of the Shamefaced Podcast to a close.
I'm Rosemary Keenan.
And I'm Vince Keenan, saying only you know what you don't know.